Case Williams v. Wendler. Mr. Fetter.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
The plaintiffs contend that the court below erred on two main rulings. And the first is a major issue is that the court wrongly held that as a matter of law, students at a state university who contract for an education and attend school do not have constitutional rights to due process before being suspended or expelled from school. The second issue I should add about the first issue that this was decided on a Rule 12b-6 motion, which is important. There was no fact-finding on this issue.
So there was no evidence presented establishing that the opportunity to be heard was a sham?
No, Your Honor, there was not.
None.
And no opportunity to do that by the time plaintiffs did depositions.
What do you mean by a sham? I didn't understand that. The procedures are okay. Well, what is it? Do you think there's a conflict of interest or bribery or what? What's the sham element?
The student conduct code provides a series of fairly elaborate rules about procedure. The plaintiffs are not claiming that there's a constitutional duty to follow all those rules.
That's not what I'm asking you. I'm asking you what are the elements of sham that you allege, right? Your complaint is all about sham. So what is the sham?
I think I see what you want me to describe. Well, what makes it a sham, there are a couple elements of it. First is that if given the opportunity to present evidence, the plaintiffs will present evidence that they violated numerous of the rules and wholeheartedly violated the rules set forth in the student conduct code.
What would be an example?
For example, the student conduct code says that after a complaint is initiated, you have 30 days in which to file formal charges against the student. They waited 4 months. The students had no idea they were being charged. The students had important to have alibi witnesses. In fact, four students were charged. Actually, nine students were charged. Five of them were merely victims of the hazing, and they were charged, in my opinion. We're going to present evidence that they were charged.
Well, this is presenting evidence, but you started off by saying this was a 12b-6.
That
was only for one small part of the case. The rest of the case was summary judgment, where you presented your evidence presented theirs, and the court found no material issue of fact.
Yes, Your Honor, but when I was when plaintiffs were doing discovery and depositions, it was not relevant to ask questions about the procedure and the procedural flaws. And if I may get back to the example.
Why wasn't it relevant? Because the judge had already dismissed the case?
Because the judge had already dismissed that issue,
okay,
Your Honor. So looking at the procedure was not.
So you had no opportunity for discovery on the sham issue, that's what you're saying?
Yes.
Now, on the sham is only relevant if you have some property, or your clients, rather, had property rights in attendance. But what's puzzling about that is if you go to college, I mean, if you're in high school, you know, compulsory schooling and so on, you have to be there. They can't throw you out arbitrarily. You have a statutory right. But in the case of a college, you don't have a statutory right. So it's just an implied contract. There's never any, I don't think you ever sign anything. So isn't the implied contract simply that you go to the school, you submit yourself to the, you know, disciplinary procedures of the school, right? So what's your property right? It's not like being a professor, you have tenure, you can only be fired for good cause. You don't have that with the student's relation with the college, do you?
Well, if I may draw an analogy, and I'm not saying 100% analogy, but this implied contract to attend classes in pursuit of a degree is not merely an implied contract to defend, to attend tomorrow's class or the next day's class, and then the university can arbitrarily at will and for no reason.
How far are you going to push this? Suppose, you know, a student attends and gets a bad grade, and he says, you know, and he brings a constitutional suit saying, look, the implied contract was that you would grade me fairly, and this grade is unfair. Teacher didn't like me, and that violated my right of, you know, substantive due process or something. Now, we can't have that, can we?
No, Your Honor, we can't. And
the dispute between a student and a public college would be would raise a constitutional issue.
The plaintiffs would sharply distinguish. First of all, some disputes, not our case, could arise about grading.
Well,
it's
that
it's conceivable,
me, right?
But it would. But the since it's not our case, I would say the plaintiffs sharply distinguish that academic misconduct is different from social misconduct,
right.
And the university student conduct code also makes that distinction. It's not just in our head.
What does that do with the Constitution, right? So suppose you're suspended for 3 years because you flunked a course, and you say, well, I shouldn't have flunked it. It was graded incorrectly. Do you have a constitutional claim?
There may be a constitutional claim, but there would not be. But the due process standard itself is very flexible, and if I think what the plaintiffs would like to distinguish is that if it was an academic misconduct, this is an area of the university's complete expertise, and if the grading was done according to the ordinary grading procedures, then that would completely answer the claim. And the only possible evidence that might make a constitutional problem is if they threw the tests down the stairs, and the ones that were highest to the top got A's, and the ones that were lowest to the bottom got B's, D's, and F's, and you could prove that.
Well, you might have a contract claim against the school, but the question is whether that would be whether it would be a constitutional claim.
And
it's disturbing to say that all of these things could be litigated in federal court under the Constitution. But anyway, let me ask you a different question about your discrimination claim. I was confused. You had a Title VI count and an equal protection count. What happened to the Title VI?
I believe the Title VI... The Title VI claim was dismissed under the summary judgment motion.
No, I know,
both the equal protection...
But in your brief, you just, unless I read it too quickly, you just argue the equal protection, right?
If so, Your Honor, then I made a mistake. I made a mistake in expressing
myself. I don't remember a discussion of...
Title VI, my understanding is that Title VI, and I argued that with the court.
You say equal protection under Title VI. Oh, you do say Title VI. Yeah, I'm sorry. My mistake.
My understanding is that they have the same standard. And so I may have argued them, been confusing because I may have argued the reasoning.
So you're saying
together.
there's no difference. But if there's no difference, shouldn't a case like this be considered under the statute before one gets into the Constitution? Isn't that a better way to proceed?
Perhaps, Your Honor, and I believe I did or did intend to argue it under Title VI.
You mentioned Title VI. That's true. That was my mistake. But did the district judge make any point about the difference between, if any, between Title VI and equal protection? Or did he just treat them as interchangeable?
No, Your Honor, I believe he did not make a distinction. But I can't,
right.
I wouldn't be certain.
Well, I'm sorry.
Is there evidence for all three levels of review that the opportunity to be heard was somehow, I'm going to use a different word, illusory?
The evidence at One piece of evidence we would have at the hearing level is that they knew in advance what the sentences were going to be, and we are going to make that charge. That's an example of being a sham hearing, what we think is a sham hearing at the sentencing. We have many examples. But at the to address this, and I think but what happened on appeal? The appeal officer who heard the appeal, the evidence is there's less of it, but they didn't answer even the direct questions. The appeal is a limited appeal. You're not allowed to appeal innocence or guilt on the question. You're allowed to appeal certain things like the length of the sentence and so forth. The Student Conduct Code limits your appeal, but even on appeal, the appeal officer did not address the questions actually asked and raised by the appellants. And so that would be an example of where the due process was lacking in the appeal.
Are sororities allowed to discriminate on racial grounds?
Are sororities allowed?
You're talking about black and white and so on, fraternities and sororities. Are they allowed to?
I don't venture to have full expertise on that question, but I would suspect that when they are licensed through a university in some form, they probably are not, although as a private club, perhaps there is some argument there. I assume that they do not discriminate other than in practice.
Why would racial discrimination, if there were racial discrimination, why would racial discrimination lead to punishing black sorority officials more than white, right? Because the university is protecting a black person, the victim of the hazing, right? So in what sense, by having a harsh punishment of the hazers, is it discriminating against blacks?
Your argument, Your Honor, presupposes that the people who do the discrimination are thinking logically about how best to benefit white people and hurt black people, and maybe at some deep level that's how discrimination ultimately works. But at individual levels, as people in the institution are making this decision, what they see is a black student in front of them, and they think black students are guilty.
But the victim is a black student. They didn't think she was guilty. They believed her about the hazing. So I don't understand why. In other words, if you have a black victim and a black malefactor, why would you expect racial discrimination to figure in the decision of a white adjudicator?
This makes the level of proof more difficult, I would agree. It raises some questions. But we all know, and history is full of black persons who collaborate in discrimination against other black persons. The law is not written equal protection.
No, I'm not talking about black adjudicators. Suppose you have a situation, a black person complains she's been hazed by the black officers of the sorority. And suppose it's adjudicated by a white person, no black people involved in that. Why would the white person, and suppose the white person is hostile to blacks, but why would that lead the white adjudicator to punish the black hazers heavily? Why wouldn't it be just as likely for this, bigot to disbelieve the black victim or to say, who cares, it's black on black,
Let's assume for the moment that it is a bigot, to make the argument clear. And the reason would be, in that circumstance, abstractly, because there's no benefit to be gained in terms of punishing black people. You don't punish the accuser. You just say she's wrong. You can punish the accused. And in particular, they're tied to black fraternities and sororities in this case, which there aren't very many. And you've suspended students in all of these fraternities and sororities. And now if you deal with a person who maybe is a bigot or maybe not, I mean, the facts remain to be proved, who has been running the judicial system at the university for 16 years and has a pattern of doing this, then you've created an equal protection problem.
That's fine, but the problem with your pattern evidence is that these incidents seem so heterogeneous, right? They seem so... There are two other cases you emphasize with the whites, the white fraternities. And they're serious, but they just are very different, and the circumstances are different, who's responsible. So in one, it's the other pledges who are doing the hazing. Here it was the officers of the sorority. How do we compare cases like that? Or how would a jury compare cases like that?
Well, in all situations of differential discrimination, and I believe this court has recognized that
discrimination implies, relevantly similar circumstances. And if you have a lot of diversity in the circumstances of different incidents, how do you...
I misspoke on a key word of what I was saying. I'm sorry. I apologize. On all cases of differential discipline, that there's a less strict requirement for exact similarity of circumstances when you're dealing with discipline cases, because discipline cases are intrinsically different and related to the individual circumstances. As to this particular case, the way the plaintiffs would approach the answer to your question is that the university defined the category of hazing. They set up rules. They said hazing is a form of social misconduct in their student conduct code, and then they published a definition of hazing in which, not only in the same definition, but the very next word after abuse of alcohol, the very next word is paddling. This is their definition, alcohol, paddling. They are, and that is in the record, Your Honor, that document. This is the university's definition of hazing. If the university believes they are both hazing the same category of social misconduct, then I believe that makes them comparable.
And I take it you don't think that on summary judgment exact symmetry is required.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fetter. Ms. Gray?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Danielle Gray, representing the appellees. I'd just like to start out by addressing some of the issues that counsel raised regarding the procedure on the procedural due process claim.
Could I just ask you one thing that I've been thinking about, and it's this. You stated in the brief that the undisputed material evidence in the record shows that the death of the Pikes pledge was not caused by hazing.
Yes.
And I was wondering, what is that evidence and where we might find that in the record?
That was actually an exhibit that was attached to the appellant's response to our motion for summary judgment. They supported it primarily with newspaper articles, and it is hand-marked as their Exhibit 11. It's a Daily Egyptian newspaper report. And it's dated April 21st, 2004.
And this newspaper report would be undisputed material evidence?
Well, if we're to accept the evidence that the appellant submitted, this is the only evidence that they submitted on the issue of whether or not the drowning was actually hazing related. And apparently they submitted the articles because they sort of chronicled the history of the investigation into the Pike incident. And in the article, it concluded that they did not find, in fact, that the drowning was connected to hazing.
Was it drinking?
Who concluded?
I believe Catherine Semmershine, who was an official with SIU, she was the one who was in charge of directing the investigation because she's the head of the organizations. But this is going by the evidence that the appellant submitted for us to look at what actually transpired in the Pikes situation. Basically, we're going by, if we're to accept their evidence, we're going by these newspaper reports.
Well, if it isn't hazing, what is it?
I believe the conclusion was that it was a fraternity-sponsored camping trip. There was drinking involved. And apparently this organization had some prior issues with alcohol use. It was determined conclusively that there was alcohol provided during this trip. It was not concluded that hazing was the result of the death in this trip.
But alcohol-related deaths during hazing, it seems, have occurred on a number of occasions.
I don't think that it says alcohol-related deaths have occurred. I do believe that it says that they have had issues with the fraternity violating their alcohol management codes. But I don't believe there's any history of...
But the district court assumed that providing beer to the pledge was hazing. And that's sort of inconsistent with your position, isn't it?
Well, I think the court was giving the appellants, obviously, the benefit of the inferences based on the standard of the summary judgment. And I think that even if we gave them the benefit of the doubt that the drinking was somehow a hazing incident, and again, I don't believe that there's evidence in the record that actually sustains that contention, but even if we were to give them that inference, I think what Your Honors were pointing out, that there's still differences between the Pikes incident that they point to and their incident. I think it is important to note that there is no evidence. They actually gathered no conclusive evidence that the Pikes drowning was caused by hazing.
Well,
it's speculation.
Unless I'm
at this point.
Wrong, things have changed from when I went to college. Everybody drank, whether you were in a fraternity or not. Mm-hmm. And hazing is limited to fraternities and sororities. Isn't that right? Is that how things kind of work?
As far as I know, hazing is usually something that is understood in conjunction with sororities and fraternity pledge processes, yes.
So this boy who had drowned had
right.
been drinking.
He was drinking.
It wasn't anybody that held him down and forced...
Right. There's no evidence that... In other words, alcohol could be hazing, but there was no evidence that he was forced to drink. There's no evidence that he was made to drink as part of any pledging process. I want to bring up briefly about some of the issues that he raised about the procedural due process claim. Counsel mentioned that he said that they had no opportunity at all to give any evidence or talk about what actually happened during the school procedure. And in fact, if you look at the record, they actually had early on in the litigation a TRO hearing where they gave substantial testimony on what actually occurred during the procedure at the school level. And they actually testified that they had a significant amount of process. In fact, as counsel acknowledged, their allegation of a sham really only amounts to their belief that certain state or certain school procedural requirements were violated. That's really the essence of their sham issue, that we don't feel that they followed the rules precisely.
Now, the procedural due process claim, that was dismissed not on summary judgment, but on qualified immunity grounds, right? Is your argument that it was not clearly established that a sham hearing would fail to satisfy due process?
Well, it was our argument that there is no clearly established right to continued enrollment in college. That's what they alleged in their complaint, that they had a property right and continued enrollment in post-secondary education. The court gave them the opportunity to point to some analogous cases to demonstrate that the contrary might be true. In fact, they couldn't find any cases because no such cases exist. We do also point out, though, even on the issue of the procedure itself, we note that the appellants have admitted in their own complaints in proceedings in the court that they actually received more than the hallmarks of due process. They admit that they received notice, a hearing. They had a full formal hearing before they were suspended. They got to present witnesses. Their hearing officer was an African-American woman, Kamisi Grace. They completely exercised all of their rights that they had the initial hearing. And then when they did not receive the outcome that they desired at the hearing, they had three independent levels of review. And in fact, their appeal went all the way up to the chancellor, Mr. Wendler, who actually reduced one of their suspensions.
What about, though, Mr. Fetter said that, you know, there was this four-month delay in filing formal charges. My question is, how did that get into the record? I thought there was no evidence dealing with the actual, with the question whether these procedures, although they look fine, were administered in a way that made them... so phony that it would be a denial of due process.
I think what they're referring to is the fact that the pledge who accused the appellants of hazing her, she went to the school's police department. She made a complaint to them. There was an investigation period. Once the police department concluded that there was some evidence on which to base a charge, the police then sent its information to the student, the Office of Student Judicial Affairs. The number that he's referring to is a 20-day period to file a for the SJA, the Student Office of Student Judicial Affairs, to act on a complaint. So what happens is, basically, that time period was the time spent actually investigating the charges to make sure that there was some foundation for the charges. Detective Leonard interviewed witnesses, interviewed other people whom the victim had named as, you know, having knowledge about the hazing.
Okay, so now this explanation, what is the basis for this? Is this in the record or in his complaint or?
I believe
he said there was no discovery about the procedure.
I think that the record he must be referring to is probably whatever he alleged in his complaint. And also attached to our motion for summary judgment, there's the police report that Officer Leonard filled out, which, you know, shows the date that his investigation was concluded. Mm-hmm. It shows the date when Ms. Conley actually initially came to him and reported that she had been a victim of hazing. So to that extent, that information would be in the record.
I just have a question, just for more curiosity. But when a student is suspended, as they were here for a couple of years, do they get a refund of all their tuition?
You know, I don't know. I don't know.
I think if you pay all your tuition for a year in September and in October, you get suspended.
I don't know. I don't know if the agreement is that as long as you do what you're supposed to do, you should be fine. Unfortunately, these young women were found to have not lived up to their part of the bargain.
That doesn't have anything to do with the particular issue we're talking about, but I just think it's sort of
so there's nothing in the... Actually, it's very interesting. So there's nothing in the record about the rules that define the rights of students in this school?
I think
Judge Evans really asking about the sort of the implied contract that the student has with the school, which might include, you know, tuition abatement. What if you get sick and suppose you probably pay in advance of each quarter. So if you get sick in the middle of the quarter and you have to withdraw, do you get a tuition abatement or?
I don't believe there's anything in the record necessarily outlining the student's rights. The appellants during the TRO may have given some testimony about what they were able to do after they were suspended. I believe one person, you know, testified she was able to go on and get enrolled in another school.
Is the handbook in the record?
I believe what counsel submitted is a portion of the student conduct code.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I may be missing something, but what has me in a quandary about the district court's opinion is that the district court concluded that the Pikes incident and this incident were different, and he appeared to view the paddling incident as more serious. And to me, that's surprising because alcohol-related deaths during hazing have occurred on a number of occasions, and it seems to me that the consequences of paddling appear to be less severe, and we're talking about summary judgment in both paddling and the provision on alcohol are viewed as hazing. One resulted in this very severe sanction, while the other resulted in no action. So, you know, why isn't that a question for a jury, whether the different treatment is race-based?
Well, I think because the evidence in the record is conclusive that the only reason why any action was taken against the appellants was because Chantel Conley actually filed a complaint. The way the SJA operates is it will act if a complaint is filed with it on any individual student.
Well, a dead person can't file a complaint.
That's correct. And that's correct. The victim obviously does not have to file a complaint. It could be a police. The police could send them a complaint. And we cite many instances where they have received reports from police departments. Typically, it is not the procedure for example, the SJA to just take it upon itself to just act against an individual, especially when it doesn't have complete information about who to actually act against. So that really is the real distinction. I have no doubt that had they received a complaint about the Pikes from anyone, possibly anyone else in the Pike fraternity or from the police department, I have no doubt that they would have acted on that complaint. It's difficult to make that comparison because we don't have a complaint file, so we can't compare to see how the school would have treated the two of them.
Let me ask you one other kind of a question, a curiosity type question. If they're suspended from University of Southern Illinois and Carbondale, does that mean they're suspended from the whole system, or could they apply to Champaign-Urbana?
My understanding is that they were suspended from Southern, but they could enroll in other universities. In fact,
is that in the record?
In their TRO testimony, I believe one appellant did testify that she had enrolled, and the court found that she had enrolled in another school during the suspension period.
So this suspension is limited, then, as you're telling us, just to Southern Illinois and other public colleges, universities in Illinois are not bound to honor that. They can admit the student.
Right, that's my understanding. They can't come to SIU, but they are free to.
One of them did, you say?
Yes, the TRO does reflect that one of the appellants, in fact, had enrolled in another school.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Gray.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll move on. And Mr. Fetter's time expired.